The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Welcome to this week's edition of Capital Thinking. I'm not Kevin O'Neill. I'm Mike Dino, Senior Policy Advisor from Patton Boggs' Denver office. And I'm guest hosting today's show in place of my Washington colleague, Kevin O'Neill. Hope Kevin's getting in his last few days of summer vacation. Here in Denver, it was the first day of school for a lot of kids. I got my 7-year-old to class, and I know throughout Denver and certainly other parts of the metro area, summer is kind of officially over, and it's time to get back to work, at least as it is for the school-aged children. Today we're bringing you the news and views of Washington with a little Western flavor. Washington's a little sleepy right now. The Congress is on break. The President's on vacation. And so we're getting a chance to talk with some folks out here in the West. And my first guest is Claude Pamilia, who is the Chief Financial Officer for the City and County of Denver. Welcome, Claude.
Thanks, Mike. Glad to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us today. And I know, being the chief financial officer of any municipality has been a challenge, certainly, in these last 2.5 years, and I'm sure you've had your hands full.
We certainly have. We've dealt with the budget situations that everybody across the country has been, so it's been an interesting time.
Well, I'm sure we could talk about that for a while, but we're really here to talk today about a project that is very exciting for the city. It's our Denver Union Station. It is going to be the intermodal hub that will link our rail transit, our bus transit, certainly bikes, pedestrians, you name it. And you've been in the middle of that, working on that, certainly very diligently this summer. Tell us a little bit about the project and the way it's been uniquely financed.
Sure. Thanks, Mike. The last several years, when we started this project, we were looking at how do we create the type of hub for our fast track system, our light rail and commuter rail system, and all the other intermodal ways of transportation that you mentioned that would be significant and have the right type of presence for Denver. What we identified was that we had this unique opportunity because we've got a lot of open land in that area. And if you look at downtown Denver, it's unique to have a situation where downtown surrounds an area where there's still so much new development that could occur. We realized that if we put this project together properly, we could stimulate the development of that part of downtown and create a much more robust hub for the system. About a $500 million project, the mixed-use development, and the big challenge for us was how would we fund that $500 million given the situation that was going on in the economy.
Well, and when you talk about a mixed-use development, what does that mean so that our listeners can understand that?
Absolutely. We partnered. We had a RFP process in which we selected a developer that would come in and work with us. Think about it, the entity that we'll talk about called DUSPA, the Denver Union Station Project Authority, would develop what you would call the rail infrastructure and the transportation infrastructure, and the private developer would develop the land around it. And the mixed-use aspect is the fact that it will have both, will have housing, it will have commercial office buildings, it will have retail sales. So all those elements will come together to make this an area where not only will people want to go and use the rail system, but they'll also have a variety of shopping opportunities, the ability to have their offices located right at this transit hub, and in addition, be able to live right in that area.
Well, and you talked about, I mean, I know you just weren't working on this summer, so it's been, you know, give us a sense of how long it's taken to really get the financing put in place, and what were some of the key elements, because, you know, speaking of Washington, we know that, you know, you or some of the folks you worked with certainly had to make their way back there to get this deal done.
We certainly did, Mike. We spent quite a bit of time in Washington. We started working on the financing in earnest about 3 years ago. To give the project its due, though, people have been working on this project for probably 10 years, but that was the planning phase, understanding what they might or might not do with the site. Once we had a project scoped and realized what the funding challenge was, at that point, about 3 years ago, we started looking at what our options were in terms of financing.
And if you can describe, tell us, you know, why Washington was such a key part of that as it relates to what were the two main agencies that you had to work with to get these loans?
Sure. You know, as we looked at this, one option that we first considered was, you know, could we go access the debt markets without any assistance from Washington? That just wasn't realistic, just given the fact that we were going through one of the significant financial crises since the Great Depression, and the fact that interest rates would just be too high. We started looking at what the different federal programs available might be, and of course we landed on the Department of Transportation, and within the Department of Transportation, we identified two programs, one within the Federal Rail Administration and the other within the Federal Highway Authority. Those programs, one is called RIF, the other is TIFIA. What they fundamentally are loan programs to finance transportation projects.
And as I understand it, I mean, there's never been a project that has tried to get financing from both these programs. So was that one of the challenges in trying to, you know, get this thing finally closed down and moving ahead?
You're absolutely right, Mike. The challenge for us and for the federal government was to think through how we could wed these two programs. If you thought about what their origins were, it hadn't been contemplated at the time of their beginnings that the highway piece and the rail piece would work together. The fact that intermodal hubs for public transportation are now becoming such a vital part of transportation strategy made this kind of a natural union, if you will. But the challenge for us was getting the different agencies to work together and to think through how they could work within the constraints of their own programs to make this work. And I have to say that, you know, in both agencies, the cooperation and the teamwork that we saw was pretty impressive that made us made this possible. It certainly was a long and difficult journey because there were a lot of just basic blocking and tackling work that had to be done to make it fit within each program.
Now, you talked about certainly the economic challenges that the city's facing and how it affected some of your options. I mean, isn't this risky trying to take on a project like this during these challenging economic times? I mean, wouldn't it be wise to kind of wait and see how things play out?
You know, we felt like it was actually riskier to not try to move this project forward. If you think about it, our whole rail system, our whole light rail system, our whole Fast Tracks program is dependent upon this hub. This hub is the part of the system that connects everything together. It will have the line out to the airport, and it needed to be completed in a certain period of time. So we didn't really have the luxury of waiting for that reason. Another reason we thought it was just vitally important to move this forward is, in the midst of difficult economic times, to get a project like this started and going has a pretty substantial impact on our economy here in the metro area. Thousands of jobs are being created as we speak and will continue to be created for the next several years as we complete this $500 million project.
And are you getting a better deal on these loans than you would if you went through a normal lending process?
That's a great question. And, you know, Mike, the great thing about this is that we're getting a phenomenal interest rate. The way these programs work is you actually lock the loans in upon closing at whatever 30-year treasury rates are. Because interest rates have gone so low, both of these loans So we have $300 million worth of loans when you combine the two programs at below 4%. So there's no way we could have matched that interest rate in any other type of financing vehicle.
Well, that sounds like it was, you know, you couldn't pass this deal up. You mentioned the tax increment financing component, and I think, you know, for our listeners, that can always be sort of a challenging concept to understand. Could you dig into that a little bit and tell us how that plays into what's going on with the project?
Absolutely. The tax increment piece is a vital part of how these loans will be paid. And the way tax increment works is, if you think about, if you looked up there right now and saw a lot of open land, that land today has a certain value and gets taxed at a certain rate. Basically, it's just property taxes because there's no retail sales going on. As this project is built up, it will create more assessed value. The land itself will become more valuable, and there'll be stores and other activities that generate sales tax. All of that new tax, if you will, that only exists because of the creation of this project, is segmented out, and for 30 years is available to pay for these loans. So in effect, it's a self-financed project. We're not taking tax revenues from taxpayers today. We're going to take the increment that's created as we build the project up.
So nobody's missing out on the parks being cared for, or potholes being filled, or police being put on the streets because you're building this project.
That's absolutely right, Mike. And, you know, one of the things that people get concerned about in these scenarios is, well, are your projections accurate? Are you really going to create that type of value in this project? And the reason people get concerned about that, obviously, is there's an inclination to think that folks might be too optimistic about their projections. What we did to rebut that is we hired actually two independent firms to come in and do feasibility studies, assess the potential of the area. And for the listeners who know the Metro Denver area, people can pretty quickly see this is one of the most attractive real estate locations in the area. One of the things that's validated that most recently is we've had two major corporations, DaVita Corporation, a Fortune 500 company that recently moved to Denver, announced that its new headquarters building will be built in this tax increment area. And then IMA, another major company in town, is also building a new office building for itself, a new headquarters right in the tax increment area. So already we're significantly ahead of our projections on this tax increment.
Well, and you talked about partnerships, and you mentioned that a nonprofit group oversees a lot of this effort. Who are the groups that are part of that DESPA group you noted?
Absolutely. DESPA stands for Denver Union Station Project Authority, and it is a partnership with a bunch of major agencies, starting with the City of Denver, RTD, our Regional Transportation District, CDOT, the Colorado Department of Transportation, Dr. Cog, and the DUS, the Denver Union Station Metropolitan District itself. All of these parties have a stake in it, have worked hard to provide grant funding or other types of funds that are available through their relationships. And this group together governs the creation of this project. This is an entity. This entity, you know, borrows and repays the federal loans, as well as manages the owner's representative who works with RTD to construct the project itself.
Well, we certainly have talked on this show before. Washington appreciates these partnerships and has found a way to really be able to reward a lot of partnerships that are coming together, where people working together, leveraging unique ways to finance. And this certainly sounds like a project that brings all that together. So you got to be very proud of getting it to this point, at least.
We absolutely are, Mike. We're very proud of the fact that the project's come together, that we've closed the loans, and that we're going to create a part of Denver here that's going to last for a long time and be a very vital portion of the whole Fast Track system. So,
great. Well, Claude, thank you for joining us today. This was very informative, and I'm glad you could be with us.
Thanks very much, Mike. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for joining us for this segment. We'll be back in just a moment with Capital Thinking.
stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202- 2-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on. Football.
Golf, racing, or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The house will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Welcome back to Capital Thinking. This is Mike Dino from Patton Boggs' Denver office. I'm guest hosting for my colleague Kevin O'Neill today. We're out here in the Mile High City. Summer's coming to a close. Kids are back in school today. Our Denver Broncos are back on the field. That always gets the Mile High City a little more jazzed up when they get a chance to see the Broncos in play. And we're looking forward to a great fall here. The opportunity to host the show out of Denver always gives us a chance to get a chance to talk with some of our folks here in the Patton Boggs Denver office. And I'd like to welcome today Dave Brody. He's a partner in our firm's energy practice in the Denver office. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me, Mike.
Well, I'm glad David has been with the firm, I think, going on 8, 9 years, Dave?
11 years.
11 years.
Time flies.
Sorry, I cut you too. But, you know, I know you had an outside assignment for a few years, and now you've got regular office hours here. It's great to have you back in the Denver office on a regular basis.
Well, I appreciate that, Mike. It's great to be back.
Dave's an expert in the energy practice, and today we're going to talk about the natural gas industry, the domestic natural gas industry. And Dave, give us an overview of it, because it's been an interesting time. We had a new administration come in, really focus on saying we need the renewables to be a bigger part of what we're doing. Certainly in this state, we've had a governor who's focused on renewables, but has also kind of created this dividing line between traditional fossil fuels, particularly coal, and, you know, giving a little leg up, it seems, to natural gas. What's going on?
Yeah, well, yeah, I will give you a general overview first, Mike, and our listeners. You know, we consume 23 trillion cubic feet of natural gas a year. And that's a huge volume. And, of course, most of it is used to heat our homes and our buildings. And then about 7 trillion cubic feet of that natural gas is used for power generation for electricity in the power plants around the country. And, you know, we have a very different situation we have with natural gas versus oil. 20 to 21 trillion cubic feet of that 23 trillion total is produced right here in the United States, and a huge amount in the Rocky Mountain area. And Denver is sort of in the epicenter of the Rocky Mountain natural gas industry, producing Rocky Mountains area produces a large volume of that 23 trillion. And Denver being the largest city between Chicago and the West Coast, many natural gas companies have offices here in Denver. So Pat and Boggs being located, as well as our Dallas office, where a lot of natural gas is produced in Texas and the Gulf, are very much in the middle of that industry. And as I was saying, there's a big contrast between the domestic natural gas industry and the oil industry, because in addition to the 20 to 21 trillion cubic feet of gas we produce here, only 1 or 2 trillion, the balance, is imported from Canada, next door, a very friendly country, versus the oil, crude oil import situation, where we consume about 20 million barrels of oil a day, and 60% of that, or 12 million barrels a day, is imported. And so we have a great domestic energy situation regarding natural gas, and a dangerous, insecure one regarding oil. And of course, gas is a much cleaner burning fuel than coal or oil. And coal still fuels most of the power plants in the U.S. So, you know, the natural gas industry sees a lot of benefits in converting over time from coal-burning power plants to natural gas-burning power plants. You mentioned that Colorado is a leader in this area, and in fact, there was a law recently passed in Colorado which requires energy from natural gas plants to be increased and convert from coal-burning plants to natural gas plants.
Well, and so, you know, you not only are making this conversion from coal to natural gas, and so that's clearly an opportunity that's out there to take advantage of this abundance of natural gas, but what are some other things that you see coming out of having this abundance of natural gas? What are the other opportunities we should be focusing on?
Well, you know, we need to expand the uses in addition to converting coal plants to natural gas plants, and look to expanding in other potential areas. And one good example is expanding natural gas use as a transportation fuel. And if I could just take a minute to talk about that, you know, there are 11.4 million natural gas vehicles in the world. So it's a proven technology, and in many, many other countries, it's common to see light vehicles, passenger vehicles, being natural gas vehicles, whereas there are only about 110,000 natural gas vehicles in the U.S. So we have to somehow figure out a way to expand the use of natural gas, much cleaner burning fuel than oil and gasoline, to become a transportation fuel.
Well, and there are, you know, there's certainly natural gas vehicles that are out there. You know, is there an infrastructure, is there a planned infrastructure to be able to develop more of that? What are people thinking in terms of trying to make that a possibility?
Well, there definitely would be, there is a need for expanding the infrastructure. There are only 350 publicly accessible natural gas fueling stations around the country, compared to 121,000 gasoline stations. So what would have to happen is to install, depending on what the goal was, but thousands of natural gas pumps around the country strategically located if the industry was able to expand the number of natural gas vehicles.
And you know, when we hear about trying to take greater advantage of our natural resource, being natural gas, and the impact that some people view, you know, and what it takes to get that out. I mean, how is, you know, how is the environment impacted by expanding our use of natural gas?
Well, it would be impacted very positively in the sense that if you transitioned both in the power generation sector from coal to natural gas and expanded the use of natural gas as a transportation fuel, we would be reducing our CO2 emissions and our nitrogen oxide emissions by literally billions of tons over time. So it would have a very positive impact.
So there's some real good things that can be pointed out as it relates to, you know, converting vehicles to natural gas, taking advantage of what is an abundant resource. And, you know, it sounds like a win-win. Would you characterize it as that?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, one of the very interesting developments in the last several years in the natural gas industry is that because of the discovery of more natural gas in what are called the shale gas areas in the Appalachians and in Louisiana and Texas, there is now, experts estimate that there is a 100-year supply, and there will be a tremendous abundance and surplus of natural gas in this country that we've never seen before. So that even makes this opportunity more important, and it's more important to take advantage of the fact that we have this stable long-term supply.
Well, you were talking about supply, and a lot of times when people talk about renewable energy sources like the wind and solar, you know, particularly the sun, there's you know, infinite supply of sunlight, and certainly the wind is pretty prevalent too. I mean, how do natural gas and renewable energy sources, I mean, how do they complement, affect, work with each other in terms of being, you know, in our energy mix?
Well, wind and solar and other renewables, of course, relate primarily to being sources of power generation. Although, you know, all of the politicians talk about how we have to reduce our dependence on foreign oil, the only real near-term solution to reducing our dependence on foreign oil is natural gas as a transportation fuel, because wind and solar are for power generation, and to the extent that we're talking about electric vehicles, that's great because we can provide electricity that electric vehicles can be charged on, and that would reduce the import of foreign oil. But wind and solar and natural gas actually have a very strong positive relationship in the sense that because wind and solar are now not really competitive without price subsidies and credits and other incentives from the government, they would benefit by having a stronger and more stable over the long term natural gas industry, because they would then become more competitive on their own with natural gas.
Well, and we got probably about 30 seconds. How are you involved? What's Pat and Boggs doing to really take advantage of this?
Well, you know, Pat and Boggs, through primarily our Denver, Dallas, and Anchorage offices, we handle all of the full-service natural gas industry needs, transactions, litigation, corporate security matters. And then we have this unique additional service that we provide to our clients, being the number one lobbying law firm in the country. So the combination of the actual development of natural gas throughout the western U.S. and also the policy and political issues, which are so important for the long-term future of the country, we are supporting the natural gas industry in all those respects.
Well, Dave, that is awesome. Thanks for taking the time to join us today, and we'll be right back with some more Capital Thinking.
Thank you, Mike.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjoe Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjoe Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Merhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Welcome back to Capital Thinking here on Thursday, August 19th. I'm Mike Dino from the Patton Boggs office in Denver. I'm guest hosting for my colleague Kevin O'Neill, finishing up a little summer break, and plans to be back with you next week. Washington's a little quiet, so we're out here in Denver getting a chance to highlight some of what happens out here in the West, about a half a continent away from our capital. And on this segment, I have the pleasure of hosting Michael Ditchfield and Roz Duman with the Colorado Coalition for Genocide Awareness and Action. Michael and Roz, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to have you here. Well, let's start off here. Roz, give us a little, since, you know, this is a Colorado-based organization, certainly has a national, international focus, though. Give us a little sense of why the Colorado organization was formed and why it was established.
Okay, well, in 2006, a group of us came together and to put together a conference on genocide and crimes against humanity to see if such an organization would be necessary. With over 200 people attending, we saw the need to establish this organization. And so in 2007, CCGAA was formed with the support of over 40 organizations as partners and a board of directors, with now being led by Michael Ditchfield as our president. And why was an organization needed? Well, I grew up with many Holocaust survivors telling my parents the stories of what they went through during World War II, and the horrendous lives that they lived during that period. And the one thread that kept going through was that there was no one out there to help them. And the world was silent. And so many years after the Holocaust and World War II, the world proclaimed never again and asked the question, what have we learned? And the answer is that we learned nothing, and never again, unfortunately, turned into yet again. prior to the Holocaust, we silently watched the Armenian genocide and many, many others during the past century. And today we're watching Darfur and the millions that are being killed and displaced and raped and taken into slavery. And our heads of state are still, even though they are doing something, they're still complacent. They're still too silent. It's not too passive, and coming out too late. And that's why we created the organization, to make sure that we would create a groundswell of people who would put pressure on our political people, to put pressure on the government of the Sudan.
Well, it sounds like that's a great part of your mission. What are some of the goals that you're trying to achieve here?
Our goals is to we're providing it as to make people aware and to teach them what they can do to help stop this genocide. Provide education for all Coloradoans through awareness programming. We're in schools. We speak all over. We have a fabulous exhibit called the exhibit is called Dead Weight of Complacency, which shows history of past genocides as well as Darfur. We work with our media so that they will promote more education and to help us promote the educational process through trying to get expanded coverage. And, of course, we work with our political leaders locally, our congressmen and senators, so that they will take action to stop these horrendous crimes against humanity by putting pressure on governments wherever genocide rears its ugly head.
Well, you know, we live here in Denver. I know you and I have had a history here, a long history of living here. It's kind of a... we're in the middle of the country. We're not as much of an international city as certainly our coastal cities or a city like Chicago, maybe even Atlanta. And so an issue of genocide seems, you know, quite far away from us
right.
at times. But describe your current project, because it's a project that it sounds like is trying to really bring it closer to people's attention here in Colorado.
Right. Well, last year, after Bashir, throughout many of the humanitarian organizations, and chaos was developed in that country more so, we decided to do something, not having a rally. We decided to go straight to the governor and ask him to proclaim Genocide Awareness Day, and he did, and that was on August 5th. We, as a result of that, we decided this year we would have him proclaim Genocide Awareness Days, and we'll be taking a bus tour or a tour, bringing the message to the people. Instead of proclaiming it on the Capitol, we're going to leave the Capitol, we're going to leave Denver, and we're going to be going through many cities in Colorado to bring the message of genocide, making people aware, and believe it or not, people have to be aware of what the word genocide is and what's happening in Darfur today. We will be traveling over 1,500 miles in a four-day period in a van. It'll be a moving billboard, actually. We will have our exhibit with us. We will be conducting press conferences in all these cities, meeting politicians, people, just to get the message out that this is happening and that you've got to do something, even though you're miles and miles away. We are still our brother and sister's keepers.
Well, in a few times you've mentioned Darfur, and Michael, I'd love to, you know, talk with you a little bit about what's happening in Darfur, and certainly they've had, you know, it's been in the international press, it's been certainly in our press, again, it seems so far away. Give us a little bit of background there and certainly what's going on today post the elections. Michael, if you can just speak up a little bit more.
Yeah. If you look at Darfur right now, a sideshow compared to what's going on in southern Sudan, which is in death. Darfur is about 400,000 right now. This 2005 really was a stepping stone, but now it's become a stumbling block. And if you look at the referendum that is coming up, Darfur could be pale in comparison to what the rest of Sudan. It only takes one person to begin a war, and it takes about that peace. We have to direct our attention. You know, the International Criminal Court in The Hague going after Bashir, and I'm all for that justice, but not at the expense of. I think that in Darfur, you've got to have a no-fly zone so that humanitarian aid groups go back in there and work, because you've got genocide by another means. Power that can get to raise the water up, no medicines can get in, and the world of just, they've turned their back on Darfur, and it's about to escalate into something that we've never seen before. Darfur is really Rwanda in slow motion. Unless we do something, escalate. We have to, as a world, you know, make a stand and be a voice and put pressures on our, you know, governments around the world. Envoys, ambassadors don't do it because they change every few years. Effectively, the world has got to come.
Who are some of your partners in trying to bring more visibility to what is a tragedy and becoming even, you know, more of one in Darfur?
Well, it's kind of alphabet soup. There's so many people in voice, you know, in the empowerment of what we can do. So from the Save Dar, the Enough Project, I mean, they're all around the world. Even Darfur, with all the athletes from around the world, that voice is the platform on which we have to keep the pressure on. And all these organizations are all doing wonderful, wonderful things. But it does come from government to government where we will see it. It's just like I mentioned about, you know, the no-fly zone, which Hillary Clinton has been a big, big, big supporter of, just like we saw in Iraq when we heard that worked. And if you take politics out of the equation, all you're left with is common sense. And, you know, we have to have some common sense right now as our platform for all the different groups involved.
Well, and again, you've got some great partners. In what the Colorado Coalition for Genocide Awareness is doing, I mean, you know, what are your strategies to prevent not only what's happening in Darfur, but other genocides that could, you know, present themselves down the line?
Well, that's a big question, and I think right now we are in a position where we can prevent another genocide. That's never happened before because, as Roz mentioned, never again. Well, we never learned from Rwanda. That was one of the biggest stumbling blocks the world has ever seen, and genocide has always been have the victims, the victimizers, and the morally culpable. Morally culpable are those people that have to stand up right now, because this referendum at the beginning of the year will determine the future not only of a country, but the whole continent. So again, right now it's that continuation of, you know, bus tours, the voices, candlelight vigils coming together. But, you know, the clock is ticking. We have to come together as well.
Well, I think the work that you and Roz are doing is tremendous. I really hope that the bus tour gets a chance for people outside of the Denver metro area to get a sense of what you're trying to accomplish here and bring much more awareness. So I appreciate you and Roz joining me today, Michael. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And good luck on the bus tour.
Thank you so much. And we hope to have it as an annual event. We'll do this as long as there's genocide in this world.
Okay, thank you. We'll be back with more Capital Thinking after these messages. Thank you.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street
to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Welcome back to today's Capital Thinking Show. This is Mike Dino, a guest hosting today for my colleague Kevin O'Neill. We're with you from the Mile High City of Denver, Colorado. And this is sort of where the action is, I would say, out here in the States now, with Washington on recess. Certainly not a lot of business left to do back there, and everybody anxious to see what's going to happen in the elections in Congress, certainly for the Senate, the House. Here in Colorado, we certainly have those going on. We have our own governor's race and state house races. But one of the things that I'm going to be talking about in this segment is with my colleague, public policy colleague Matt Needler, about what's going on the ballot initiatives. Matt, welcome today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you know, everybody's always wondering what's going on with these horse races between this candidate and that candidate and the Republicans, the Democrats, and these third parties. But Colorado's ballot has some initiatives on it that really could affect how government runs itself in this state. Give us a little insight. I mean, we've had a history of ballot initiatives that have ultimately passed and changed the way we do business in government. Tell us a little bit about the background and what we're expecting this year.
Yeah, I mean, this year is a crazy year for some initiatives out there. It's very easy to get on the ballot in terms of circulating petitions to get an initiative on the ballot in Colorado. It's one of the easiest states in the nation to do so. You can an amendment to the state constitution is just as easy to put on the ballot as a statutory change to state law. So a lot of people, if they don't like what they see in the legislature, if they don't feel like the legislature will abide by their statutory changes they may propose, they may just simply run an amendment to the Constitution. So back in 1992, a very famous one that's been modeled around the country passed initially, and that was the Taxpayers' Bill of Rights called TABOR. And it's a series of limitations on the way that Colorado's government is allowed to grow. Basically, the main formula is that government revenues can only grow by population plus by the rate of population plus the rate of inflation, which usually comes out to around 6% in Colorado. So over the many years since then, Colorado's been under Tabor, but there were a lot of provisions in Tabor. You would have to vote on tax increases
there's several important elements to it, but what people and the public need to understand is that the government anywhere in Colorado cannot raise taxes on their own, right?
Right. You have to ask the voters for permission or to incur debt. And one of the other things you can do is choose to not abide by some Tabor provisions. They call that de-Brucing after the Tabor author, Doug Bruce. Who also factors into these initiatives that we're about to discuss. So many cities and local governments have de-Bruced over the years since Tabor passed and don't live within all of the same constraints as Tabor. They still do votes on tax increases, but other than that, so basically Tabor has been was really impactful, especially in the 1990s. People can remember getting big Tabor refunds every year, but then the economy turned south. And not only by then had many local governments chipped away at some of the provisions of Tabor that they have to abide by, but state government did as well. And one of the biggest ones was Referendum C in 2005, which suspended those growth limits in the context of the down economy. Then you also had, a couple years ago, the state legislature sort of permanently change the way that school districts would have to calculate their tax base revenues, or and they wouldn't have to refund revenues, etc. So all of that combined, Tabor was a really impactful provision that over the last few years has been chipped away, and a series of ballot measures have been introduced this year, which I sort of read as a list of pet peeves by the author of Tabor. Who has seen these provisions of his amendment chipped away, and so
it seems that these are sort of the sons and daughters of Tabor. It looks like people in Colorado, a good faction of them, have wanted government to have less of a presence in everybody's lives. Tell us about, there's three of them. We have Proposition 101. Amendment 60 and Amendment 61. Can you give us a brief overview of each of them? Because each individually is a little confusing. Then you throw them all together, and you're kind of wondering what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so the two, the Prop 101, that's a statutory change, would gradually cut the state income tax from 4.6% down to 3.5%. It also basically phases out vehicle registration fees, car sales taxes, and telecommunications taxes. I mean, not just cut them, but almost eliminate them down from, several hundred dollars per car to a dollar per car, for instance. And this is all money that goes into our highway funds, et cetera. So that Prop 101 is a statutory change. Then you've got Amendment 60. That's the one that really goes after some of the things that have been chipped away at Tabor. It basically rescinds all of the local governments, all the voters who chose to opt out of Tabor, those de-Brucing efforts that I mentioned earlier are then rescinded, and especially with regard to property taxes. Another point that it has is that schools must phase out one half of their current tax rates by 2020. The assumption is that the state would have to make up the lost school revenue. So really radical changes there in Amendment 60 to the way that property taxes are put on the ballot, voted upon, and also how they impact our schools. Then finally, Amendment 61, which is particularly confusing because it reads that the state can no longer, is basically prohibited from borrowing. But what that also means is the state is prohibited from bonding. So
you can't use the type of financing where you go out and sell bonds to the investors and then get that money up front, build something, and then over a period of time you pay it back.
Right. One of the many mechanisms that Tabor still allowed for is that while government couldn't always, it would have to ask for voters if it was to go into a general debt or bond, you could always have a specific, you could set up a specific fee to pay for a specific bond through an authority mechanism in state government. Local governments would still be allowed to borrow under Amendment 61, but local governments would be really restricted. For instance, they'd have to pay back any bonds within 10 years. So those three together.
Tell me who is all, you know, who's being affected by these if one or all of them pass.
You know, if they all pass, you're looking at a between, you know, $3 and $5 billion reduction in state and local government revenues over the next few years. It's one, you know, there's a lot of people who support Tabor who still oppose these measures because they just go far beyond some kind of a tweak. They would really cut a government budget dramatically.
So transportation, higher education, K through 12, I mean, they would all start losing their funding streams and could be just devastated.
It would be a really radical change in the way government looks in Colorado.
Well, gosh. Well, I know folks be out there trying to make their case for either side of it. Matt, thanks for giving us a little bit of an overview of that today. And if we have a chance to come live from Denver again, maybe we'll get an update and see where those are going as we get toward November 2nd. Is any one of these got a good chance of passing?
You know, I've heard that a couple of them, you know, on their face, they look good. People don't like debt and borrowing right now, but this is much different. This is as if, you know, banning people from having mortgages on their house. It's that kind of a scenario that really blocks government from functioning.
Well, we'll hope that maybe they don't make it past November 2nd. Thanks for joining us today, Matt.
All right.
This concludes our Capital Thinking Show from Pat and Boggs for this week, and have a great day from Denver, Colorado.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.